mostly lying. This entire so-called war, actually genocide, in Gaza has been based on a series of lies, some of which the Zionist regime continues to peddle. For some, in the mainstream media, it took months to accept the obvious fact that the Zionist regime has been lying about the events that led to the war and the military objectives of its constant targeting of hospitals, schools, shelters, and other civilian facilities. So, it was only logical for the Zionist regime to lie about killing the six internationals and their Palestinian driver of the World Central Kitchen, WCK, notwithstanding an event as atrocious as this. It is implausible for the Zionist regime to start telling the truth now. Luckily, few seem to believe Israel's version regarding WCK or its continued massacres elsewhere in Gaza. The Zionist regime cannot credibly investigate its own failure in Gaza, the U.S.-based NGO said in a statement on April 5th. The issue of targeting these internationals, however, has to be placed within a larger context. The Zionist regime was hardly secretive about its intentions to deny Palestinians even the most basic necessities of survival in Gaza, epitomized in the words of the Zionist regime war minister Yoav Gallant on October 9, saying, "There will be no electricity, no food, no fuel, everything is closed." Initially, this statement and many others were understood at the time to be an outcome of the Zionist regime's desire to punish Palestinians for the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood operation by resorting to its typical tactic of collective punishment. Within time, however, and based on statements made by other Israeli regime officials, it became clear that the Zionist regime wanted to ethnically cleanse Palestinians altogether. The Zionist regime's stratagem was immediately rejected by Egypt, Jordan, Arab countries, and eventually by other governments around the world. The Zionist regime, however, persisted. Israeli regime finance minister Bezalel Smotrich said that the voluntary migration of Palestinians in Gaza is the right humanitarian solution. Netanyahu concurred, "Our problem is finding countries that are willing to absorb Gazans, and we are working on it," he claimed. But for ethnic cleansing to take place, several prerequisites had to be fulfilled. 1. The bulk of Gaza's 2.3 million people had to be forced to the south, as close to the Egyptian border as possible. This has been achieved. 2. All aspects of life had to be destroyed throughout Gaza, including all hospitals and clinics. The most obvious examples were grisly massacre of the Al-Ahli Hospital on October 17th, and the bloodbath and eventual total destruction of Gaza's largest medical complex, Ashrafa, on April 1st. When the Zionist regime military pulled out of Ashrafa area, they left behind one of the most tragic scenes in history of modern warfare. Hundreds of bodies were hurriedly buried in mass graves amid charred buildings and indescribable ruins. Limbs of children were sticking out of the dirt, whole families tied and executed together, and other crimes that would take the world a long time to fathom, let alone explain. Still, and nonchalantly so, former Israeli regime Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that not one civilian was killed in Ashrafa. Again, the Zionist regime is lying. Three most shelters, bakeries, markets, electric grids, and water generators had to, from an Israeli perspective, also be targeted so that the hapless population, especially of northern Gaza, would realize that life there is simply unsustainable. Becoming fully aware of the Zionist regime's ultimate plan of inducing a famine in Gaza, Palestinians fought back. The counter-Palestinian strategy was predicated on ensuring that as many Palestinians as possible remained in northern Gaza, and that those concentrated in Rafah were not pushed into the Sinai Desert. Aside from the ongoing battle between the Zionist regime's army and Palestinian resistance in Gaza, there was another type of war taking place. Israel's push for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and the latter's desire to survive and remain within the Gaza borders. This is precisely why the Zionist regime killed countless Palestinians involved in the work of facilitating life in northern and central Gaza. According to the United Nations, prior to the killing of the six internationals, the Zionist regime had already killed 196 humanitarian aid workers. This number does not include doctors, medical staff, civil defense workers, police chiefs, and officers, and anyone contributing to sustaining life in areas that the Zionist regime wanted empty of its inhabitants. Even when, under international pressure, the Zionist regime had allowed limited aid to enter northern Gaza, the Israeli regime military repeatedly killed and wounded Palestinians who desperately gathered in the hope of receiving the life-saving supplies. According to an April 4th report by Euromed Human Rights Monitor, the Zionist regime has killed 563 Palestinians and injured 1,523 when it bombed people waiting for aid at designated spots in northern Gaza, or when it bombed distribution centers and workers responsible for distributing the aid. The Kuwait roundabout area in Gaza City alone witnessed the murder of 256 starving refugees, while 230 others were killed on Al-Rashida Street elsewhere in the city. Israeli regime bombing was not random, as the Zionist regime also targeted and killed 41 police officers who had worked with volunteers from various Gaza clans to help the UN refugee agency UNRWA distribute the aid among the famine-stricken population. Even the clans themselves were targeted in equally merciless bombardments. And similar to the outcome of the attack on the WCK workers, each time the entity responsible for the aid would declare that they would no longer be involved in aid distribution. This is how Gaza's hunger turned into outright famine. The latest killing of the internationals in Gaza was done to serve the same goal, ensuring that no aid distribution mechanism is allowed. Ironically, the involvement of the World Central Kitchen was itself an outcome of a U.S.-negotiated agreement that would deny the Gaza authorities and even UNRWA any role in receiving and distributing aid. The Zionist regime must be stopped at any cost, and the Israeli war criminals must be held accountable for one of the greatest genocides in modern history. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be examining the links between the Israel lobby and the National Conservatism Conference. We'll be identifying who else is involved and unpicking their agenda. First up is Latifa Abu Chakra, who has this report about some of the unsavoury characters associated with this collection of extremists.
In April 2024, the far-right and Islamophobic National Conservatism Conference, which has been held annually since 2019, will be taking place again, with previous conferences being held in London, Washington, Rome, Miami, and Brussels. The conference will be rolling into Brussels again this year, which is the centre of political power in the European Union. But what is this conference and who is behind it? The National Conservatism Conference, or NatCon as it's known by its supporters, brings together far-right and pro-Israel politicians, commentators and Christian religious leaders from across the Western world. The gathering seeks to promote right-wing ideas about immigration and a supposed clash of civilizations between the so-called Judeo-Christian West and the Islamic East. The conference is organized by the Edmund Burke Foundation, a think tank led by the Israeli-American nationalist Yoram Hazony, who is also chair of the Herzl Institute in Jerusalem al-Quds, named after the father of modern Zionism, Theodore Herzl. The conference's organizing committee also includes another Israeli, Ofer Havry, who is the vice president of the Herzl Institute. The list of speakers at NatCon this year includes former British Home Secretary Suala Braverman, the honorary president of the right-wing Reform UK party, Nigel Farage, and the pro-Israel writer, Melanie Phillips. Braverman has been a staunch supporter of Israel for many years, but she became notorious in 2023 with her attempts to crack down on pro-Palestine protests in London. She tried to influence the Metropolitan Police to outlaw the flying of the Palestinian flags and said that the protests against Israel's genocide in Gaza were hate marches. Similarly, Nigel Farage has been a staunch voice for Israel in Britain. In addition to claiming that Muslims helped to stoke anti-Semitism, he has been using his public influence since the 7th of October to rally support for the Zionist entity. Meanwhile, Melanie Phillips has been stoking Islamophobia throughout her career, and her writings were even referenced in the manifesto of Islamophobic neo-Nazi Anders Breivik, who murdered 77 people in a terrorist attack in 2011. Whilst not all of the far-right supports Israel, and many right-wing commentators, like Candice Owens, has recently spoken against Islamophobic hate-mongering, the speakers at NatCon appear to be linked together in their support for both Israel and Islamophobia. The purpose of NatCon is therefore to sell support for Israel to the far right and to promote those far right elements that support Zionism and the illegal occupation entity that is committing a genocide in Palestine.
Joining me in the studio as usual is our resident expert David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University and is now a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest contributor today is Kerim Ali, who joins us via Skype. Kerim is an activist who coordinates with pro-Palestine groups to develop innovative ways to campaign in the legal, political and creative spaces. Welcome to the show. David, we heard in the report there, didn't we, about this conference pushing the Zionist idea of a clash of civilizations. What's that all about?
Well, the clash of the civilizations is an idea which was put out by Samuel Huntington, the US-based intellectual, where he was saying that the difficulty with the Muslim world was that they had different ideas to us white Western people, and therefore that there was no way round saying that there was going to be a clash, and that you know really is an ideology underlying the idea that we have to, at will, invade countries in West Asia, Afghanistan or Iraq or Libya, Syria. That's the whole idea. The whole idea is that we simply cannot get on with them, and them, of course, is Muslims. And that applies also then to domestic policy issues, and that's what's fueled quite a lot of the Islamophobia, which has arisen especially since 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kerim, I mean, we know that the former British Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, took part in the conference last year, and she's speaking again this year. Just outline, will you, her pro-Israel politics.
Suella Braverman, firstly, is part of the Unequivocal Support for Genocide fan club. Her politics of being pro-settler Zionist essentially are to the extent that even after nearly 6 months of genocide, she is still concerned with the UK's government backsliding of support for the settler regime, in her words. Not only that, she is strongly opposed to the BDS, the Boycotts, Divestment, Sanctions movement, and has been vocal in her opposition to this, as well as her further criticism of any other anti-Zionist bias, and especially more recently, and perhaps more perniciously, pro-Palestinian protests, which she has essentially characterized and demonized every participant in those as hate marches. Really and truly, it's Suella Braverman who is the opponent of British values, fundamental British values of democracy and freedom of expression and the like, which she is allowing her pro-Zionism to cloud her her position, if you like, with the United Kingdom and its domestic policies.
Mm. Well, David, the pro-Israel commentator Melanie Phillips is attending this year's conference again, isn't she? I mean, just outline, will you, what her role is in lobbying for Israel and indeed promoting Islamophobia.
Well, Melanie Phillips is a hardline Islamophobe, as perhaps many people will know, but she used to be someone who was perceived as being on the left. She always thought of herself as a liberal, not as a leftist, but she was worked for The Guardian for many years in social policy and welfare, and she wrote things which made her seem like she was maybe on the centre-left. But after 9/11 especially, she started to concentrate especially on Islam and Muslims, and by 2006 her articles on Muslims were outnumbering the articles that she would do on education, for example, one of her other big topics. So she's become more and more obsessed with the idea of a threat from Muslims. She wrote a book called Londonistan about Islamization of the UK. She's talked in relation to Israel-Palestine about the Arabs being morally depraved, and she's used the word savages in the past about the Palestinians. So you can see the kind of analysis that she has. She's a very strong ideologue within these circles. She's perhaps more extreme in her Zionism than many of the others who are in those circles, including some people who are quite strongly and staunchly Zionist. So she's a sort of a sign, really, of the extent of Islamophobia within the Zionist movement, because she is so anti-Muslim, and she doesn't even bother to hide it.
No, indeed. I mean, she certainly has been a huge change. Because I remember attending seminars and conferences in the late 90s, I think it was, where she was introduced as a kind of lefty, kind of socialist speaker. It's kind of really odd, in her outlook. But Kerim, the conference is about national conservatism, but of course not all conservatives agree with this sort of pro-Israel politics, do they? I mean, what kind of divisions have emerged on the far right about this?
It's been very interesting to actually make note of these divisions developing over the last few months. And those divisions seem to follow the fault lines that they see the Zionist regime's treatment of Palestinians as a form of ethnic oppression that contradicts their stated values. And this has especially come to light as of late after 6 to 7 months of genocide, where it's beyond clear as day for many, many analysts and observers. There are also isolationists who oppose UK or US intervention in the Middle East or anywhere further afield, to be honest, and they object the gifting of military aid and so on. This is sort of in line with those who would see the British government as defunding the NHS in order to fund the IOF. However, there are some national conservatives who argue for a sort of America first or a Britain first approach, and that policy of focusing solely on domestic interests over foreign entanglement. So while it may not necessarily suggest that they have a sympathy or a lack of sympathy towards Zionism, or at least towards the settler state, in the regard of British policy, they have a sort of, they have an approach where there's no strong position there. More interestingly, perhaps looking over across the pond in America, these fault lines have caused great tremors and earthquakes in the far-right spheres, with Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro and the like. Candace Owens, who's just been sacked from the Daily Wire, severed ties with Ben Shapiro, primarily over comments made late last year, where she tweeted very openly that no government anywhere has a right to commit a genocide ever. There is no justification for a genocide. I can't believe this even needs to be said or is even considered at the least bit controversial to state. So this shows the insulation, the levels of insulation that the Zionist movement goes, at least in the United States, in order to in order to protect its name. And as well as that, she has accused pro-Israel groups of having an insane amount of power and influence over U.S. foreign policy. So it's not just the fact that she feels very strongly, and other far-right analysts and right-wing observers feel very strongly towards the lack of humanity shown towards the Palestinians. It's also the fact that they feel that there is a an influence and a creeping hold on policy decision making via external forces.
Yeah. Well, David, Peter Thiel, the American venture capitalist and an entrepreneur, has spoken at these conferences previously, and he's supplying the Israeli occupation forces with technological support, isn't he?
That's right. So he runs, co-founder of Palantir Technologies, I guess quite a well-known tech firm for being involved in kind of intelligence-linked activities. And in January this year, he posed alongside officials from the Zionist entity's Ministry of Defense, signing a new contract, which was intended, it said, in their announcement, to help the war effort, by which, of course, they mean to help to kill Palestinian women and children in the genocide in Gaza. So this is the kind of people who are in there. This is very much, people say, national conservatism, but this is a Zionist project to try and, how should we put this, to cultivate and colonize the mainland of conservatism for the Zionists. And of course, the kind of fallout that there's been from that on the far right, as Kerem has just been saying, has been quite marked and is an ongoing process. The Candace Owens example is perhaps the best current example, but there are many other examples of people on the right who are peeling off from the Zionist project, and the people in national conservatism are fighting to keep some of them behind.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to our discussion after our second report, in which we profile Yoram Hassoni, who leads the Edmund Burke Foundation that organises the National Conservative Conference each year.
The National Conservatism Conference is organised each year by the Edmund Burke Foundation, a think tank led by Yoram Hassoni, who is an Israeli-American nationalist and is also chair of the Herzl Institute in Jerusalem al-Quds. Hassoni's Ukrainian Jewish grandparents originally settled in Palestine as part of an early wave of colonists in 1924, but his parents would relocate to the United States in 1965. Out of his own nationalistic and pro-Israel passion, Hassoni moved back to the Zionist entity in 1986. He went on to serve in the Israel occupation forces, helping to suppress the First Intifada with a unit deployed in Ramallah. Hassoni's support for Zionist extremism even led him to publish a farewell message in the Jerusalem Post to the ultra-nationalist militant rabbi Meir Kahan upon his death in 1990. Kahan was notorious for co-founding the Jewish Defense League terrorist organization. While Hassoni claims to have never adopted Kahan's view, he nevertheless expressed his gratitude to the terrorist extremist and bid him a most painful, heartfelt farewell. In 1991, Hassoni became an aide to Benjamin Netanyahu when he was the deputy foreign minister, serving on the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who had previously led the Zionist terror gang called the Ergun. Since leaving electoral politics in 1994, Hassoni has published a number of books on Zionism and nationalism. In his most recent book in 2022 called Conservatism, A Rediscovery, he called for an alliance between conservative Christians and observant Jews to struggle in support of nationalist ideas. He also rallied against immigrant communities. In the case of Germany, he said that the admission of immigrants from West Asia was plainly a destructive measure, and said that the strengthening of domestic Muslim communities had the potential to contribute to internal dissension, dissolution, and violence. Hazzoni is typical of modern Zionist thinkers who seek to create a so-called Judeo-Christian alliance against Islam and Muslims. That is precisely what the National Conservatism Conference seeks to promote. Speakers from across the Western world are invited to give speeches and promote ideas that form part of a pro-Israel Islamophobic framework. As part of his conference, Hazzoni has access to prominent British ministers and United States politicians. Effectively, Hazzoni appears to act as a lobbyist for the Zionist entity's diplomatic objectives abroad, which includes the promotion of Islamophobia and the marketing of Zionist talking points among Western politicians and commentators.
David, Hazzoni has openly stated that he's a Zionist, and yet he tends to write more about nationalism than he does about Zionism. I mean, why do you think that is?
Well, as we saw in the film there, he's in the Edmund Burke Foundation, which, you know, Burke, of course, an icon to conservatives.
Of course.
Not really much of a contributor to or influence on Zionism at all, as far as I can make out. So this is about going into the mainland of conservatism and colonising the territory. So, of course, he doesn't want to talk about Zionism too much. He wants to present himself as being a conservative. Now, of course, many of those who are involved will understand and know that that's what's going on, but it's really also about bringing in those who are not so clear that they are Zionists or not so clear that Zionism is the number one thing driving them. And so they want to bring on board a whole series of people in the conservative movement more broadly, and that's what's behind these different tensions that there are within the conservative movement, and I would include the far right in the conservative movement here, such that there are some splits on this, and especially as the genocide has continued. People like Candace Owens, who is absolutely on the far right, have split off from accepting or turning a blind eye towards genocide, and many of those even on the Christian right have taken a position which is much more in solidarity with Islam and with Muslims than it is with the Zionists. And that's very worrying for them. So what they have to do with the National Conservative idea is to try and recoup some of that territory and to colonise more territory in the conservative movement for the Zionists.
Of course, in this country, one of the far-right leaders, Nick Griffin, has similarly taken a very strong position in opposition to Zionism. So it is a curious state of affairs. But Karen, I mean, it's rather ironic, isn't it, that Hazzoni talks about Jewish-Christian alliance when Israel is actually oppressing Christians in Palestine?
Some might even say that Jesus is one of Palestine's greatest exports. So yes, it is very ironic that the Zionist regime is currently wiping out what seems to be the tiny remnants of Christianity in the Christian community, at least in Gaza, and more largely in the West Bank. Most Zionists also seem to view Christians as inferior theologically and unworthy of equal rights to themselves. And the so-called Jewish-Christian alliance is simply about gathering support in the West, garnering support in the West for Zionism, especially almost exclusively amongst the evangelical community, particularly in the USA. Although the alliance itself of a Jewish-Christian community has no historical or contemporary basis, there have been many, many reports over the years of Palestinian Christians facing many difficulties due to Zionist occupation policies. For example, the restriction of movement, home demolitions, the inability to access the holy sites in Jerusalem and Bethlehem, especially come Christmas time and others, and other human rights violations. So while Hazzoni preaches an alliance based on shared religious heritage, the reality is that many Palestinian Christians feel that their lives, their rights, and probably most importantly, their ability to practice their faith freely is undermined by Zionist policies that Hazzoni endorses, introducing an element of course, hypocrisy and cognitive dissonance, which, as we have found, is not often too uncommon amongst the far right, or at least in Zionist circles.
Mm. Well, David, I mean, when the conference came to London in 2023, there was a lot of criticism from the British left, but they didn't tend to focus on the kind of pro-Israel nature of the conference. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's part of the same historical blind spot which the left has on Zionism, which we've mentioned and discussed on a number of occasions in this show. I mean, the left doesn't get that Zionism is itself an ideology which has its own means of development, which has its own aims and objectives. And those aims and objectives, well, they might on occasion, and have for many, many years now, intersect with those of American imperialism, indeed previously British imperialism. They're not dependent ideologically on the US, and they have a different trajectory, and they want to develop themselves as their own imperial power. That's why Zionism has always been maximalist and expansionist, wants to develop into what they call a greater Israel, which in various different conceptions also means Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and part of Egypt and parts of, and most in fact of Iran as well. So Zionism is something which has its own internal directions, and people on the left don't really understand that. They tend to see it as being simply the attack dog of Western imperialism, and so they don't notice the Zionist elements of conservatism, and indeed they're much more comfortable in saying something's conservative than saying it's Zionist, because they feel that if you start to say it's Zionist, that might somehow end up as being anti-Semitism. And that's kind of the weakness of the left's position on this, is that they're fearful of walking into fire from the Zionists. So they try and avoid things which makes them effectively mouthpieces for Zionist talking points in some respects. And that's really quite worrying, I think.
Mm. I mean, we've seen how anti-Semitism has been absolutely weaponized, but I wonder whether, as well as that fear factor, you talked about the conservatism conference being sort of colonized by the Zionists. I mean, would it be fair to say that sections of the left have been colonized in the same way then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that there's large sections of the left are colonized by Zionism. They see themselves as openly Zionist, but I think even those sections of the left which are critical of Israel, they might believe in the two-state solution. They might even conceive of themselves as being anti-Zionist. But even in those cases, there are elements of their thinking which bears the traces of the Zionism from which they've come, many of them. And so that is an issue. So the whole question of de-Zionization is not just for card-carrying Zionists. It's also to get rid of the ideas of Zionism which have infected other parts of the society.
Yeah, of course. Well, Karen, would it be accurate, do you think, to say that Hazzoni is part of the war apparatus against Gaza at the moment?
Yes, I mean, while there's no evidence to say that he's directly lobbying politicians about the war, I mean, we could certainly say that he has at least one son and three nephews that are serving in the IOF. That aside, it does appear that he has been sort of normalizing the Zionist entity amongst Western politicians and going to conferences and giving speeches about it for many, many years. He plays a small part in a broader Israel lobby, perhaps, that seeks to bring onside people of influence in politics onto Zionism, especially the media and beyond, to ultimately support the death machine that we are seeing. In fact, it was only about 3 weeks ago or so that he gave a presentation at Columbia Law School in America justifying the Zionist actions as essentially an expression of nationalism, that what they are doing is the right thing to do. And so in that regard, you could certainly say that he is being rolled out to justify the Zionist genocide against Palestinians.
No, indeed, indeed, indeed. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So thanks to our guest, Karim Ali, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next time, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more forensic investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Scientists are saying melting polar ice is changing the Earth's rotation and affecting how we measure time. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The US national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. How much can change in a second? The impact of climate change has been felt across the globe in rising temperatures and rising sea levels. But a new study suggests global warming has accelerated the Earth's rotation, affecting the way we measure time. The Earth's rotation governs the hours, minutes, and seconds of the day across the world in Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, which was made the international standard for time measurement in 1960. Since 1972, Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, has been modified by adding leap seconds when necessary because the Earth's rotation rate is inconsistent, according to Britannica. The added second of UTC makes the last minute of December, or June 61, seconds rather than 60 seconds, according to the encyclopedia. However, for the first time, UTC, or Coordinated Universal Time, may have to lose a second in what would be called a negative leap second, according to a study from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California at San Diego, published on Wednesday, 27th of March, in Nature. In total, there have been 27 added leap seconds to UTC, according to researchers. But the impact of subtracting a second is unprecedented. While losing a second may seem minuscule, in theory, the impact on universal computing systems could be severe, according to Patrizia Tavola, a member of the Time Department at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures in France. Earth's rotation seems to have accelerated, outpacing the time standard and raising the possibility that an unprecedented negative leap second might soon be required. A daunting prospect in a world reliant on consistent timekeeping. Precise Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, timekeeping is needed for satellite navigation, for software, telecommunications, trade, and even space travel. The study, led by geophysicist Duncan Agnew, suggests a negative leap second, which could be implemented as soon as 2026, may be delayed by the impact of global warming to 2029. The delay of the negative leap second comes from the acceleration of melting polar ice in Greenland and in Antarctica, which is measured by satellite gravity, according to the study. The melting polar ice has decreased the angular velocity of Earth more rapidly than before, the study notes. Since 1972, when Coordinated Universal Time, UTC, became the global standard for timekeeping, the angular velocity of the liquid core of the Earth has been decreasing at a constant rate that has steadily increased the angular velocity of the rest of the Earth, according to the study. To put it simply, global warming has accelerated the Earth's rotation, forcing global timekeeping to adjust. A negative leap second has never been added or tested, so the problems it could create are without precedent, according to Tavella. UTC, or Coordinated Universal Time, is currently computed using data from about 450 atomic clocks, which are maintained in more than 80 institutions around the world, according to Tavella. In 2022, scientists and government representatives voted to remove leap seconds from UTC by 2035 at an International Bureau of Weights and Measures conference in France. The resolution was passed by the Bureau of Weights and Measures 59 member states and other parties at a general conference on weights and measures. However, Tavella now suggests the uncertainty associated with predictions of Earth's rotation and the evaluation of whether a negative leap second will be required must be assessed before 2035. Meteorologists around the world are following the unfolding discussion attentively, with a view to avoiding any unnecessary risks, he wrote, adding, Earth's rotation is an imperfect timekeeper. Planet Earth has now broken warmest month records for 9 months in a row, according to a new report by Copernicus, Europe's climate change service. February 2024 broke global temperature records, rounding out the warmest winter on record in the Northern Hemisphere from December of 2023 through the end of February at 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit above the average, according to the new report released on Wednesday, 27th of March. Average surface air temperature in February measured at 56.37 degrees Fahrenheit, 1.46 degrees above the average from 1991 to 2020, and 0.22 degrees above the previous warmest February in 2016, according to Copernicus. The month as a whole was 3.19 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than an estimate of the February average for 1850 through to 1900, the designated pre-industrial reference period set in the Paris Climate Accord. CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story and tells us more. One day in the next couple of years, everyone in the world will lose a second of their time. Exactly when that will happen is being influenced by humans, according to a new study, as melting polar ice alters the Earth's rotation and changes time itself. The hours and minutes that dictate our days are determined by Earth's rotation, but that rotation is not consistent. It can change ever so slightly depending on what's happening on Earth's surface and in its molten core. These nearly imperceptible changes occasionally mean the world's clocks need to be adjusted by a leap second, which may sound tiny but can have a big impact on computing systems. Plenty of seconds have been added over the years, but after a long trend of slowing, the Earth's rotation is now speeding up because of changes in its core. For the first time ever, a second will need to be taken off. A negative leap second has never been added or tested, so the problems it could create are without precedent, according to Patrizia Tavella, a member of the Time Department at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures in France. But exactly when this will happen is being influenced by global warming, according to the study published on Wednesday, 27th of March, in the journal Nature. Melting polar ice is delaying the leap second by 3 years, pushing it from 2026 to 2029, the report finds. Part of figuring out what is going to happen in global timekeeping is dependent on understanding what is happening with the global warming effect, said Duncan Agnew, a professor of geophysics at the University of California at San Diego and the study's author. Before 1955, a second was defined as a specific fraction of the time the Earth took to rotate once in relation to the stars. Then came the era of highly precise atomic clocks, which proved a much more stable way of defining a physical second. From the late 1960s, the world started using Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, to set time zones. Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, relies on atomic clocks, but still keeps pace with the planet's rotation. but as the rotation speed is not constant, the two time scales slowly diverge. This means a leap second must be added every now and then to bring them back into alignment. Changes in Earth's rotation over the long term have been dominated by the friction of the tides of the ocean floor, which has slowed down its rotation. Recently, the impact of melting polar ice, driven by human burning planet-heating fossil fuels, have become a significant factor. Professor Duncan Agnew says, as the ice melts into the ocean, meltwater moves from the poles towards the equator, which further slows the speed of Earth's rotation. Ted Scambos, a glaciologist at the University of Colorado at Boulder, who was not involved in the study, describes the process like a figure skater spinning with their arm over their head. As they bring their arms down towards their shoulders, their spin slows. Polar ice melt has been large enough to noticeably affect the rotation of the entire Earth in a way that is unprecedented. According to Professor Agnew, to me, the fact that human beings have caused the rotation of the Earth to change is kind of amazing. But while melting ice may be slowing the Earth's spin, there's another factor at play when it comes to global timekeeping, according to the report, processes in the Earth's core. The planet's liquid core spins independently of its solid outer shell. If the core slows down, the solid shell speeds up to maintain momentum, according to Professor Agnew. Very little is known about what's going on roughly 1,800 miles below the Earth's surface, and it's not clear why the core's speed is changing. It's fundamentally unpredictable, according to Professor Agnew. But what is clear, according to the study, is that despite polar ice melt exerting a slowing influence, overall, the Earth's rotation is speeding up. That means the world will soon need to subtract a second for the first time.
Dear listeners, this is the second part of A Window to Palestine. A Window to Palestine.
Ya estamos de regreso para seguir las conversaciones que hemos tenido.
We are now back to continue the conversation we had to learn about the Palestinian diaspora in Chile. Today I invite you to talk with Valentina Salvador Huagui, a Chilean doctor of Palestinian origin, who has been working recently since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza with a group of doctors to try to help. Let's learn a little bit more about Valentina through the following video.
Un poco más sobre Valentina.
Valentina Salvador es nieta de palestinos.
Valentina Salvador is the granddaughter of Palestinians. She studied medicine and is a specialist in surgeries for oncological diseases. She learned the love of cooking from her grandmother and grew up with recipes that she still continues to prepare and that connect her with the cultural traditions of her homeland. In 2017, she traveled to Palestine as part of a program that brought together the diaspora from different continents. She returned with the memory of a kind, happy, and welcoming people who enjoyed life with simplicity despite the tensions of the occupation, the wall, and the many shortcomings. As part of the Doctors' Society of Palestine, where some 300 specialists participate, they began to pressure scientific societies to play a more active role and denounce the genocide. The events, however, have led them to continue their work raising funds to send medical supplies through the Chilean embassy in Egypt. Valentina believes that not only is the lack of food and water serious, the treatments that were left unfinished, the lack of vaccines and the lack of medical care in short are also other slow and silent ways of exterminating the Palestinian nation.
Hola Valentina, muchas gracias por haber aceptado esta.
Hello Valentina, thank you very much for accepting our invitation. You are third generation. On what date and for what reasons do your parents migrated here?
Acerca de la llegada de tus padres.
Bueno, I'm sorry, your grandparents.
De mis abuelos, sí. Daniel, muchas gracias por la invitación. Un honor.
Well, of course, my grandparents. Daniel, thank you very much for the invitation. It is an honor to be here representing the Doctors of Palestine. Look, my family on both sides come more or less before the Nakba. It was mainly as a result of the persecutions by the Ottoman Empire. For example, my family name is Salvador. My grandfather arrived in Chile around 1910. Several of his children were born in Betlalal, but my grandfather was born here in Chile, in the town of Catamu, where they settled upon their arrival in Chile. On the other hand, in depth, my grandfather's wife, Victoria Issa, came to Chile directly from Palestine. Around 1929-1930, my grandfather's father arrived here with them, and from there, in the bottom line, the family has settled in this land.
Aquí hay dos eventos que es importante destacar.
Here there are two events that are important to highlight. It was around the First World War that the Palestinians arrived. Turkish Ottoman Empire decided for the first time to force the inhabitants to defend the empire in any possible wars that might arise. And they began, for the first time, to recruit the firstborn children, the eldest of each family. And that makes many Christians and also Jews send their children out of Palestine to avoid taking them to the war. In the case of the grandmother, she surely came because of the great general strike of the 29th, where the colonization process had already begun, and we were at the gates of the Nakba, but the Nakba was already planned. This is very interesting because this also generates surely the same thing that happened in your family. A generational gap. The children of that do not have much of a relationship with Palestine. They do not pass on the language, for example. And it is always the third generation that recovers Palestinianity. What was that process like? What was it that set it off? And what are you up to today?
¿Qué fue lo que lo detonó y en qué estás hoy día?
Mira, tal cual como tú dices.
Look, just like you say, it happens to me also. Well, obviously, in my parents' house, they spoke an Arabic language. And being born in Chile, they kind of had to recover everything because in Chile, things were a little different. It's just like you say, they kind of experienced Palestine in the house.
Cosa que para nosotros fue diferente.
Something that was different for us. I think I get emotional because of the topic, sorry. But I think I have returned to it. I come from a school with a lot of social sense, a lot of politics. I don't think I had ever questioned it, like where it comes from. But yes, I think it was my dad who instilled it into me. Regardless of the fact that I seldom spoke, there was always these Palestinian things in my house. Always, always. Everything had to do with it. Food, traditions. And I think this provoked my sense of curiosity to investigate what this Palestinian thing they were talking about is. So I started to investigate, to learn from history. When people spoke to me, I like to have information and tell them what this is, what Palestine is, what is happening, because they asked me at school. Deep down, there was an important Palestinian group that would talk about the issue of Palestine, and sometimes I felt like I had to participate in such arguments. The Palestinian issue always resonated in my head. It's good, it catches my attention, because I'm the most Palestinian-like person in my generation.
In fact, you are the first to travel to Palestine.
Exactly. In 2017, I said that I really have to go. I have to see what happens. And in addition to being the most beautiful trip of my life, at the same time, it is also a very powerful trip. Encountering this reality of injustice and encountering this reality of their everyday lives are really heartbreaking. And it is sad because they are very good people, a good nation, but in the end, they are having a hard time on a daily basis. And they are used to it. They have normalized this. I have friends who have instilled resistance into their lives. They don't have the possibility of being seen. I have a group of friends who are actually marathoners called Right to Movement. And they were in Chile here recently. And the truth is that I kind of see in them a hope of getting out of this. But in the end, there is no great help for them to achieve this hope.
Como que finalmente no hay ayuda mayor como para que lo logren.
Hay una pregunta que
There's a question that I always ask here because not many people understand it. When I took my first trip, I had a very special feeling, and I want to know if you felt the same thing and how you experienced it, because here you were actually returning to a place where you have never been to.
Yes, it's very strange.
Three different facets of the Zionist project. First, some Israeli citizens are enjoying watching the genocide from a hill in the occupied territories and cheering their army doing what the Nazis did with them. It is as if it were a film made in Hollywood. Second, we see an Israeli project, a real estate project to be located in the Gaza Strip, a coastal area oriented towards the north and with tourist potential, highly desired by Western imperialists. Third, we see images of the Nakba and all the destruction and this whole plan known as the Plan Dalet to expel about 700,000 Palestinians, destroying 500 villages, and the life, history, and geography of those who had lived in this territory for centuries. Well, let's see the story on the maps to see the evolution of this, to see if, indeed, as Finkelstein said, what happened on October 7th justifies what came afterwards. Does what has happened in the last 75 years justify the complete dismantling of a fascist and neo-colonial regime like that of Israel? This is Palestine at the beginning of the 20th century, where Jews, Christians, Muslims, and atheists lived together without any problem and in absolute peace and brotherhood, with a proportion of the Jewish population close to 5%. Shortly after, in the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland in 1897, Theodor Herzl, recognized as the father of contemporary Zionism, presented his project called the Jewish State to form a Jewish national home in Palestine. Of course, the lobby carried out throughout the West and with the main powers of the time allowing them to achieve in 1917 the Balfour Declaration, known as the formal beginning of the Palestinian tragedy. Great Britain, the current England, without having any right to do so, committed themselves to the Zionist organization and to give Palestine a group of foreigners coming from all over the world. This declaration was put into practice by an illegal immigrant that sought to change things on the ground and change the proportion of the population. In 1947, the population of Jewish religion was about 30%, but above religion, the Zionist population came in, but not only as refugees seeking support, but to start the programs of Tsarist Russia and also the Nazi Holocaust. They came to usurp everything. They made the newly born United Nations, which had been created from the failure of the Society of Nations, approved the partitions of Palestine, an organization that was established to protect the right of self-determination of the people, approved the partition of Palestine. And guess who were not invited to the meeting? The Palestinians. That is, in complete absence of the main owners of the land, they gave 55% of historical Palestine to the Zionist organization and 44% divided into three unconnected zones to the Palestinians. Clearly, there was no possibility that either of these two states would be consolidated as they were intended. Obviously, the Palestinians rejected, but Zionism also rejected it and advanced in the war of 1948 until it occupied 78% of historical Palestine in 1980. What we know today as occupied territory remained in the hands of Jordan and Egypt, but this lasted about 20 years until the war of 1967, where Israel made use of its great military power and its always strong support from the Western powers, and mainly from the United States, from Europe and Germany, tried to pay the blame for the Nazi Holocaust with Palestinian blood. They advanced on the entire territories and on the heights of the Syrian Golan and a strip of Lebanese territories that remained occupied for more than two decades. Today, after years of extermination, after years of a genocidal policy on the parts of Israel with the Oslo Agreement, the Palestinian territories are reduced to a 15% and also in the form of small Bastustans without connections to each other. In such a way, they not only intend to drown the Palestinian population, but also the Palestinian economy. Now they continue encouraging or forcing in every possible way the Palestinian population to leave the place. But we Palestinians have resisted stubbornly. We have stayed on the land to which we belong, and we have no intention of abandoning this land to make way for the continuity of the neocolonial Zionist project. And that is why we today face an ongoing genocide in Gaza, because the leaders of the Zionist project have understood that the foreigners can never defeat those who have remained